like a nut tap from your favorite rapper slash soccer player. It's That So MLS.
Oh, ooh. They didn't show. Sorry,
that wasn't
in
the highlights.
That was not in the highlights.
So this is news to you?
Yeah. Okay. But what kind of podcast is this? What kind of podcast is this?
Oh, right. This is a North American soccer podcast with myself, Nick Thornton, and with me, as always, is Andrew Bates.
Hello.
How's it?
Yeah, they completely omitted any reference to a ball cap of any kind.
Well, can we please let's just
handball?
Cover it right off the top of the bat.
Was he sent off for it? Was Seattle's Clint Dempsey sent off for handball?
Sort of. Clint Dempsey of Seattle was sent off for punching a defender in the balls in the 13th minute of their game. So yeah, let's call that handball.
I worked late that night. I was not able to access that game, but whoa. When you were watching the highlights, they just cut in as the VAR rectangle is being
drawn. Yeah, I've noticed that MLS has decided to, in all their highlights, cut out the actual video review replay parts, and they only will show you the decision, which I'm not sure I really understand. I would think if you were aiming for showing the growth of the league and showing transparency, you would show at least the initial run of play. Again, maybe not showing every single angle of it, but it's peculiar to me that those are not making the highlights, but obviously they have their own agenda.
Well, in these key matches like Seattle and like Vancouver's game, every week we tell people to not get sent off.
And they just keep doing it.
We're giving them good advice.
We'll talk about it in a bit. And there's lots of cases, and with most calls and with most red cards, there's always going to be two sides of the same story. But, you know, it's not that hard to not deliberately punch a person in the dick. Just saying. If that's your go-to, I mean, the funny thing is like Dempsey is such an oaf, and you know, he's been known for violent conduct in the league. But the thing is, like, he's a fantastic player. I don't get what he's messing around with. Like, he's taller than the defender. Why don't you just jump and try to win the ball, not pounce and win his ball? I don't know. It's just very, it seems very foolish, and like only one result was going to come of it. And then Seattle struggled yet again, and got another really, really poor result, and Dallas just running them over 3-0.
Seattle had a really bad week because they started the week losing in midweek. After getting that 1-0 result at home, a lot of people, or this is the sort of the take that I had relayed on the podcast last week, was that not all of these results, when they're at home, can bear out over the legs. And Seattle lost 3-0 to Chivas down in Mexico, and then came back and lost 3-0 in Dallas.
Yeah.
So it was a rough week for them. And one of the things that I was trying to look at was there's not a lot of mention that they had that they played a changed lineup. Do you think it was that they were tired, or what do you think led to that?
You know, I was going to ask you the same, like, what is causing this sort of implosion in Seattle? I mean, these were title contenders last year. And I mean, of course we can talk about Toronto and their woes in a second, but I mean, it's early days. I think losing Jordan Morris is a big piece of that. And I don't think people quite understand how much of a piece he is, not just in terms of his talent and what he brings to the team, but just in terms of the locker room. And that Seattle still, as we know, is looking for kind of a DP critical piece to fill the hole. But you know what? I'm not really sure. I'm not an expert on Seattle and what's going on, but from the game against Dallas, granted they're playing with 10 men for most of the game, the notes that I had there was just that there was never really any midfield pressure. And you know, when you've got, at least to my limited soccer knowledge, is if you're playing with 10 men, of course you want to sit back and defend, but you want to kind of plug up midfield a little bit and make sure the center of your, the spine of your team is really in place. And yet Dallas was just being given all kinds of space to operate. And, you know, in particular, Mears just looked like he was really out of step. And that back line that's looked so good for so many seasons and hasn't undergone a major facelift just seemed totally incapable of dealing with the pressure from Dallas. And you've frozen. Nope, there you are.
That back line has been having some difficulties early in the season.
Yeah, and I mean, when you see, not Mears. Mears doesn't play for them anymore. Who am I thinking of? Sorry, it's the end of the day. Well, one person also is part of that back line is Chad Marshall, and you know, every single Dallas goal, he just seemed to be in the wrong place, sliding in late. Not putting pressure on, not stepping up to his man. And, you know, Chad Marshall's been one of the most consistent defenders in the league, I think, for a really long time. I don't know if it's just the team trying to find the right gelling at the beginning of the season or what's going on, but they looked really, really poor again against a Dallas side that has been re-energized, but we also know has struggled as well.
I think it's good for them. I thought it was... I found myself a little surprised when I saw the beginning of the game is all in the more packed end, and then it pans back around, and there's nobody in the other end. They've closed the whole end of the stadium off, like Chivas Days, which is not a good omen.
Mm-hmm. Torres, Roman Torres, goodness me. Apologies to Roman Torres. But yeah, just... In some ways, I think it was a theme of a few games this week. It's just that there's no pressure on the ball, and teams are being given tons and tons of space to operate and take shots and find the little pockets. And it's especially bizarre coming from Seattle, a team that's excelled so well in the defensive end.
Yeah. I think that this was a team... As much as going back two finals ago, it was built a lot around Ladero. It really was kind of an ensemble team, especially last year. And you're right about Jordan Morris, but also Jovan Jones being gone is a big deal. And they've got newer players that were in both these games. Like Magnus Wolf Ekrem,
possibly my new favorite name in MLS.
The difference it seems between the two lineups really is that Bruin was the sole striker up top, and Dempsey was in the hole in Mexico.
In someone's
and
then hole against... in Dallas. Oh, sorry, cheap shot.
Well, yes, Dempsey was the target. Had a target in Dallas. Moving up into the striker position with Wolf Ekrem sliding into the middle and Hantwala Buana out on the wing. So it looks like Bruin, the major starting absence that I'm seeing there is Bruin.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't think Seattle should be too worried. I think they've got the right ingredients there. I think this might just be a case of just a poor start to the season, and similar for Toronto, the focus on the Champions League, whether you're successful or not, I think does take away somewhat your focus on the league. We certainly saw Vancouver struggle with that at the beginning of the season last year. And it affects different teams differently, right? Like some teams crash out and then are able to refocus, and for some teams it's going to take a while to recover.
I got asked these questions because I got to ask these questions at work because the TFC win both in the first leg of the CCL and they lost the second leg 3-2 against Tigres in Monterey, but by virtue of having scored two at home, they won on aggregate. And I thought it was a really, really strong result. Obviously, the own goal was fortuitous. The Giovinco free kick was masterful, and I think that the interest in watching Toronto play at this level is already there in terms of if the knock on Giovinco in his free kicks is that he's playing against inferior defenses, then to see that his free kick hit the glove and still go in is a is an interesting, you know, burnishment for his reputation. They were very lucky that that last minute penalty didn't cost them, which was crazy. That was like in the 90th minute. They scored the goal before that. It was still late. It was still in the last 10 minutes. And Alex Bono is trying to dig the ball out of the net, and there are three Tigres players that are around him, like press ganging him. Like, they're reaching around him to grab the ball out of his hands because there's not that, which is, it's just, you can tell he's like, what is this? What are you doing? It drew attention. They're going to move on, which is, I think, really interesting. There's still two legs. These opponents don't get any less challenging as you go along. So I would say that necessarily being a contender is tough, but they do look, when you see them out of MLS and at this level, they still look like a real top-rate club. Yep. Now, the question...
No, sorry. I'm just agreeing with you.
The question, though, that I was asked is, does it make sense to put so much focus on the competition at this point in time?
Yeah, you know, it's really hard, and every year we ask this, and last year we asked it a little more because Vancouver, of course, was in the contention for a little bit. It's difficult because ultimately you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. If you throw everything into CCL and you do well, then you can justify it. But then when you come back into club play, or domestic play rather, and you don't perform for tired legs, lack of focus, whatever, then everybody says you should be focusing more on the league. The era where MLS teams sort of put out their B teams in CCL seems to be over. It's really difficult to decide what you should do. And ultimately, somebody else made this point on Twitter a while ago, but like, these are professional athletes and competitive athletes. They want to win. It doesn't matter if they're playing for, you know, the Copa del Rey teacup on the Isle of Barbados, they want to win it. And especially when you have a chance to play against really good clubs, you want to sort of prove your mettle in a way. So I honestly don't know as a coach, if I was coaching a team, what I would do, if I'd want to put more focus on one over the other. I think if you're Toronto right now, you're kind of going, well, they know they've got a great club. They know they're not a team in crisis. They just won the championship. So why not focus on CCL for a couple of months? Go in and try to get some good MLS results. But at the end of the day, if you make it to the playoffs, that's the most important thing. They don't need to be Supporters Shield winners again. They can afford to lose some games at the beginning of the season in order to participate in CCL. And
they did last year, too.
If they get to the playoffs and they're the fifth seed or the first seed, it doesn't really matter, because then it's a playoff bracket and ultimately you've just got to go in and win those games.
Yeah.
So I think there's actually a level of pragmatism to Toronto's wanting to focus more on this. That's not true for every team necessarily. But similar to Seattle, I don't think you could really be ringing the alarm bell just yet.
Mm-hmm. The Montreal-Toronto game was interesting to watch. Montreal won nothing in Olympic Stadium. They were trying to do the trying to cherry pick this, I guess, as their big game. Unfortunately, I would say, well, I don't know what you would call unfortunate. The attendance was 26,000, which is which is good. It is not what we've seen in that building before, but it's, you know, it's good in terms of the league's overall attendance.
Yeah, and I think maybe we did see a bit of an example of some tired legs and lack of focus, and needing key players to turn around and come back and perform again. And certainly Toronto had chances, but my big takeaway from this game was just really Montreal. We saw how good of a team they can be, but how patient of a team they can be. They have really patient build-up, and sometimes it can be criticized as kind of slow or aimless and not really doing much. But really seeing Piatti's ability to read a game and just patiently sit, and as well as find all the right little pockets to maneuver. You saw everyone, all the forward players, sitting really close to their defenders and just waiting for that final ball to come through and turn. We've seen the same technique not work against other teams in MLS, where they've perhaps been too patient and have struggled to put a game away. But from what I saw of this game, it really looked like Montreal was the better team throughout. And maybe it's not the most electrifying football, but at the end of the day, they are a team that's comfortable absorbing pressure and just waiting for their opportunity to come. The question is, can they convert enough of those opportunities over the season to have it add up?
Yeah, that is a question, especially because you are relying on young players to not make mistakes a little bit when you're soaking up pressure. And that is, like, obviously putting somebody in that position is the only way to learn how to do it. You get yourself into trouble sometimes. And I think that, was it Yuka, or am I thinking of a different game this weekend, but did Yuka Ratayal get himself into trouble again? I can't recall.
I can't recall that goal either.
No, not on the goal because he didn't score. But the point is this 5-3-2 setup, and the idea of sort of soaking up the defense, it can work, but just the tactic alone will not be successful. Yeah. And if people figure out how to exploit it, it doesn't matter sort of how many people you put.
Are you saying with Toronto or Montreal?
Montreal.
I agree. I'd say, though, that was kind of Toronto's tactic, and Montreal proved that they could find a way through. I agree, and I think we've seen this, plenty of evidence of this, is that's very hard to do over the course of every single game for an entire season, and teams will eventually find a way to exploit it. You know, Giovinco had a couple of sort of near looks at goal, but I don't want to take anything away from Montreal. Obviously, Toronto had just played in Champions League that week, but I think Montreal demonstrated that they put on a thoroughly professional performance. They knew they would only get so many chances, and they took their chance and won a crucial 3 points.
Absolutely. The other team that was in CONCACAF Champions League play was New York. They had a great week.
sort of.
New York Red Bulls beat Club Tijuana 2-0 at home. They were the only team of the three that was playing at home, and they took advantage of it. And I would say that they also took advantage of it through through some unlikely players. You saw Bradley Wright. Oh no, both. I'm wrong. I thought that for whatever reason Wright Phillips was the passer, but maybe that was in the course of the Portland game. Portland got rocked again, didn't they?
They sure did. They did?
Or am I?
Oh man, we should do shows at this time all the time. I don't think Portland played, did they? Did they?
Oh no! I'm wrong. Red Bulls lost. I was looking at the wrong week.
And in other news.
That's right, because it was New York Portland. They're playing the same game every week. No. RSL hosted the Red Bulls, and they were able to make it work. Not only were they able to score against a team that has been looking great this year, but they were able to hold it throughout the whole game.
Yeah, and you know what? I think we talked about this last time. I've been really impressed by the sort of almost new look of the New York Red Bulls with some of the younger players that they've been able to bring up through the ranks, some out of necessity, but I thought overall they've looked really, really good again this season. And RSL has shown that they're continuing to rebuild and readjust as needed, but I thought this was a really, really great performance from them. Particularly, if I can find my notes here, I mean, the early penalty that Rusnak converted, I mean, it was such a silly thing to give up so early into a game, and one of those ones where you really have to kind of side with the referee and be like, well, I mean, that can happen. and good, I love seeing young players develop in the league, and Rusnak is one of them that I really like him a lot, and I think he does all the right things and is a credit to himself and his work rate. I'll also say, this was one where we saw Raimondo's been kind of shaky over the last season and a half. I mean, over the course of the seasons, obviously his body of work speaks for itself, but this was just such a good, solid performance from him of showing the strength of his positioning, but also his reflexes. We know he's quick,
yes.
But he had a couple of fantastic saves, and you know, against a team without such a stalwart goalkeeper, maybe the Red Bulls would have come out ahead. My question is, can RSL continue this throughout the whole season of relying on Raimondo to bail them out? Because we've seen them kind of rely on that in the past with differing degrees of success.
Yeah, you had the MLS Legends goalkeeper matchup between Raimondo and Robles. Mm-hmm. And while I think that Robles is on better form, Raimondo with his beautiful save that he made late on in the game certainly took the day.
Absolutely.
It was just looking at the setup here. They, as great as Rusnak was, and there were some good chances later on. You kind of got the sense that they're still figuring it out on offense, Salt Lake.
Yeah, and I mean, I wouldn't put it out of the question that perhaps there's a summer signing on the way to help bolster that attack. Obviously, we've seen the type of speed that they have when they break, but it's still just one of those things that's not quite there yet. Of course, it's early days in the season, but they look better, but they still look very similar to the same RSL we saw last year. And I'd like to see them tighten that up a little bit, because with the speed that they have down the wings, I'd love to see an RSL back at full strength and really pushing teams like we know they can do and have done in the past.
Mm-hmm. Thinking of a team that has not always seemed at the most full strength, I was really impressed with Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
That was also a kind of game we were talking last week about. A preseason lack of focus on defense, and God knows this game didn't have a lot of great defense in it.
I so wish we had a different story to tell each week. I didn't want to just write notes for every single game for defending again. This was one of them.
People just got tore open
they
in this
sure
game.
Sure did. And, you know, one thing that I want to point out is, okay, the Zusi goal, the wonder shot, is an incredible piece of skill and a great goal, but there's nobody stepping up to him. And we already have said for the first 2 weeks, it's like just players being allowed to run and so much respect shown, like get a body on the ball and challenge a little bit, close down that space. Why are you going to let Graham Zusi dance around the 18-yard box and find the perfect position to take the kind of kick we know he's capable of? It's just ridiculous. I mean, even a mid-rate defender or defensive midfielder should have been putting some pressure on that ball and making it difficult for him, but he looked like he was taking free kick practices.
Yeah, that is one thing I saw a lot this week, is people just standing around and watching the ball go in the goal.
Oh, that's a good goal.
I did think that it was you're right. He had forever out there. I feel like that might be a tactic that you employ for, well, I'm not going to say lesser players, but if you don't necessarily think that somebody's going to be able to score from outside the box like that, maybe you're trying to guard against it. But Susie is so good, and that was such a you really got the sense that that was a turning point moment, because Kansas City had gone behind. They'd come up, but they really could have been 50-50. I thought that opening penalty was so stupid.
So stupid how?
Just from what I got to see of it.
This is the one where the San Jose goalkeeper, I'm blanking on his name, but he comes out and just cleans out the player.
Well, it was really like a... It was the sort of thing that you would expect, like a central defender. Like it was a hard nosed English central defender move to just clean the player. I believe if they had just played it, forward, but they were in no position to do it. And if there was no contact, it certainly looked like the studs were up. I have no idea. Why, his name is Andrew Tarbell. I have no idea why a goalkeeper is doing that.
When you said stupid, I was like, I think it looked like a pretty clear penalty, but you're saying from the
goalkeeper. We had this.
Yeah, it's a pretty shoddy decision-making.
Yes, it was.
And it's one of those things where he wins the ball, but it's the follow-through where he just comes in and completely cleans out the player, so much that he somersaults over him.
Yeah.
Like, it just... yeah, really, really stupid. And then, you know, obviously sort of changes the tide of the game. I was surprised that there wasn't more of a call that penalty.
I might have the player name wrong, right? Because it was I might be wrong. That might have been our good friend Tim Mielihara.
No,
it was Tarabella.
MLS like to pride ourselves on the depth and accuracy of our research that we do before each and every episode.
I remember
it's the
everything.
Show of, wait,
I remember
who's
every
the guy?
Thing
who's the guy
only
that,
yesterday.
Wait, from the thing? Portland.
Yes. Okay.
One of the things that I took away from this game, and I'm always nervous about watching highlights. And admittedly, I just watched the highlights of this game. But of any game in MLS, the five goals or more game, where you know it's 3-2 or it's 4-3 or it's 5-4 or 6-7 or whatever MLS scores happen in a week, because you go at that point, what does it really tell you besides teams can't defend? But one of the things I was really impressed about here is that San Jose has shown some real glimpses of what they're capable of this season. And you know, we were talking about Wondolowski sort of being the MLS poster boy in many ways, but this was a game where he really showed how smart of a player he is, because he was sitting right in the pocket between the two central defenders or center backs, and that's how he got his goal. He's such a great classic striker and knows where he needs to be, and that I think is going to continue to be a really dangerous weapon for San Jose. Not just Wondolowski, but similar to Montreal, is finding those little pockets and, you know, sitting close to your man and just turning them. And you'd think that after all this time, people would have figured out Wondolowski and that he's going to do that, right? He's going to sit right between the defenders and he's going to stay there the whole game. But it's another thing to actually execute it. And I thought this was a really great game for Wondolowski, and I think San Jose probably feels a little unlucky that they came away with a loss. However, if you're going to come out and clean out the feet of an attacking player, if your goalkeeper's going to do things like that, then you're always going to run the risk of losing games.
The nicer way to say that the defense was bad was to say that the positioning was great.
Yes, I'm picking the high point here. Wondolowski has great positioning. Beware of the Wondolowski and the fact that he's going to turn you like a carousel or something.
One game that I was not impressed by was Philadelphia Columbus.
Yep.
In which nothing happened.
The less said, the better. I was expecting more from this game, actually. I think I had a couple of Philadelphia and Columbus players on my fantasy team because I thought there could be some goals in this game, but it was sort of like a fart in the wind at the end, and just both teams canceled each other out, and really nothing of note happened.
Somehow I had the most disappointing attendance on a week in which a game was played in a literal park. That was they attracted 50,323 to PPL Park, while in Washington, DC United, while it still tries to sort out its Audi Place problems, had to host Houston at the Maryland Soccerplex, Maryland.
Yeah. You know who wasn't excited about it? DeMarcus Beasley.
That is where you typically see the Washington Spirit of the NWSL. I heard people thinking that it was going to not even be full because of the issues, the scheduling issues. So people were saying that this had a real shot to beat Chivas USA's old record of the MLS low attendance record. But they didn't. They made it through.
Yeah, it... When I tuned in, this was actually one of the games I did watch, and I tuned in and I was just like, the fuck is happening? Are they actually playing, like, just on a field outside somewhere? Turns out, yes, they were. a soccer-specific field in the middle of nowhere. But I also glad that you nice. Point out that, like, we're so outraged and it's so unprofessional for an MLS team, but yet it seems it's apparently good enough for NWSL. Like, yeah, we can give them better than a little kid's pitch, please.
Yeah, and I mean, like, that's at the end of the day, they have also played. It just speaks again to the, like, you can't judge DC United through this, but it's a sign of the way that the game, the way that the league itself has grown, in that DC has played games here before in the U.S. Open Cup against smaller sides. It's not, we're not so good that we can forget when teams like Vancouver were playing in front of 6,000 people in Swangard Stadium. But the product has elevated itself to this point where it's just weird to see two MLS teams playing each other in this type of venue.
Yeah, and then it starts snowing, and it's always weird when it snows during a game anyway, but it is MLS. But DeMarcus Beasley was quite unhappy and took to Twitter to rant about how, you know, the changing rooms were basically just a bunch of cloths thrown up between vending machines. And I can understand the frustration as well, especially in away game. You've already got the travel against you, and then you show up to something that doesn't have a proper facility. I sort of take his point. Overall, kind of an interesting game. A 2-2 draw in the end.
Yeah.
Darren Maddox scored again, which I'm sure is baffling people to no end. That I think... If I'm not mistaken, does he have 3 goals in 3 games now, or is it just the 2?
They VAR'd him right after that, which was really funny, because he's sitting there being like, don't take my fucking goal. Don't take my fucking goal.
It could be a while.
jury's out. I will let you know in a quick
That's
minute.
Okay. I'm looking I'm whether looking or not too. It was his... But I was actually impressed with both teams.
I'm seeing three. I'm seeing three and three.
No, it's two.
Sorry. Two and three. I was mistaking GS for goals scored. Instead of game started.
That's not a stupidest thing to make. But, you know, considering they've got the run in the big star Yamil Assad, who only has one. I mean, granted, I know it's only 2 goals. But Darren Maddox certainly fits well within the system, which we've talked about before. And I was impressed by what I saw from DC, and I was impressed by what I saw from Houston as well. Difficult conditions to play in, but both teams, I thought, gave it their best crack. I think DC, again, we just saw a little bit of loss of focus again. And, you know, we're unfortunate not to win the game. And it's just that defensive... focus that I think needs to be tidied up, and I think DC could be you know, a really difficult opponent to play this season in the East.
Albert Elise was great. He is everywhere on the pitch for Houston, it seems, and was the author of many of their early chances.
Yeah, you know, it's always interesting to see a player like Elise who kind of bursts onto the scene, and you kind of wonder, okay, but can he do it next year as well? And he picked up right where he left off. My question, sort of watching him, is how long can MLS keep him?
I guess all you could do is just ride it as far as you can.
But throw money at the kid, keep him in, because I love seeing him in the league. But admittedly, watching him, you go, I mean, he is a little bit a step ahead of other people. Like, he is a different pedigree that likely won't stay in MLS his whole career.
The first goal was great from Houston. The one thing I also wanted to compliment about the second goal, and I had this comment on another goal this weekend, I just have to remember what it was it's so important to keep the pressure on, because when a ball is cleared, it's so easy to let the focus switch. But this was a case where Houston were, I think, able to hold it in and kind of catch DC going the other way. In a scenario where they were not expecting to continue defending for any more seconds, and they were able to exploit that and get to the ball to the open man again. Great positioning.
Well, and we know that Houston can do this, and I think that's what makes them so dangerous, is that until that final whistle blows, unless you're up 4-0, Houston can tie and possibly beat you. They're frustrating to watch sometimes because they've got so much speed and talent, and they'll just fluff the ball and take poor shots, and you can watch that for 20 minutes and nothing happens. But boy, I think any team playing Houston just can't wait to hear that final whistle go, because they do like scoring late goals.
I'm definitely impressed based on the way that sort of set up, and the not home atmosphere that DC was able to come back and get the point. If you're trying to sort of diagnose whether or not they've come around, that's a great sign.
Yeah, I agree. It's good for them to get the point.
Would I want them to get things that aren't draws? That would be nice. It would be good of them to do that. However,
so this, you know, under tough conditions and against a really tough opponent like Houston, a team they're not going to play a lot, I think it is a good result, and DC has to take away from it that they've definitely got something to build upon, and they've made massive improvements over last season. And as we talked about, when they do finally get into their proper stadium, hopefully they can ride this momentum and continue on and push themselves even further, because there's still times where I feel like there's a bit of a hangover from last season, and they're kind of like, I mean, are we good now? Well, I'm not sure. And I think they just need to accept that they are good and just play with a little bit more freedom and confidence, and they could be, again, a really, really difficult opponent.
If you look at sort of the numbers, and I think they're having a play, I think that was their home opener, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Indeed. That's going to really hurt them compared to when Atlanta Stadium opened in the middle of the year. They were playing those games at the university campus, and they were still drawing 40,000 people a game before they even moved into the Mercedes-Benz Stadium. But now, DC has the chance to generate that buzz if they can sort of get the ball rolling and become a product and an atmosphere that people want to pay.
Yeah, I think having Acosta back is going to pay dividends, and it feels like they finally have their full squad that they designed off season playing together. Once that's clicking, that's more likely to happen.
Yes. I did, by the way, track down which goal it was. That was the other no-hoper was in New York City versus Orlando. New York beat Orlando 2-0 at home. The first goal was scored by Ismael Tajiri, who caught it was just sort of the wrong moment for Joe Bendik, who late in the game was trying to clear the ball and cleared it right to his feet.
Yeah.
The feet of the attacker.
It was kind of a poor pass back from the right back that started that. And you saw Joe Bendick kind of had to move to position himself to take the ball and then just, yeah, royally fluffed it and passed it straight to New York City.
which is again a word for keeping your focus on attack, because these mistakes happen.
Indeed. And yeah, ultimately I see this as kind of a game that had a couple of mistakes. But Orlando just needs to deal with the second balls. Like, it's still looking very disorganized and chippy, and they can kind of win the first tackle, but they lose the second. Or they clear the first ball, but they don't clear the second. And they've got to start tidying up those mistakes for them to really become a contender. It's interesting that there's still so much hype around this team and how good they could be. But if they're not able to tighten up those things defensively, they're going to have a really rough go of things this season.
Yeah, it was rough for them. And I don't think until that point, I think it opened the game a little bit for New York. There wasn't a lot going in either direction. So they were putting together a pretty good performance. Although Miram looked great again. I think he had one really stellar chance closer to the end. But they weren't able to put together as much until sort of things got dire.
Indeed. Dyer, not Dwyer. Yeah, there's still potential there, but I was surprised to see how little of an impact Clushton had on the game now that they've got him back in the fold. And, you know, New York City, of course, we know is a good team, but I think everyone's sort of saying now of Orlando, like, okay, you got your players, you changed things, like, let's see it. Let's see what you can do. And the team is still gelling, but I think people are going to start to get a little impatient and say, okay, like, let's go. I mean, you've got some of the best midfielders in the league. Where's the midfield pressure on teams?
I would say that if you, in the early going of the season, you look at the standings, you can't trust them. You don't really know what they mean. But if you are Minnesota United looking at their positioning as tied for first in the West... with four other teams, or the three other teams, you got to think that was a great result for them against Chicago, winning 2-1.
Mm-hmm. It was a great game. Ibsen is just something else, and it's so fun to watch. And I'm really glad for Minnesota. I thought they got such a tough time last year, and people really wrote them off because of some horrific results, but. Boy, they've really turned things around without shipping out the entire team. And it made Chicago look like a Minnesota this season. Like, Chicago just looked really unsure of what to do and how to deal with things. And except for a couple of little mistakes, one costing them a goal, Minnesota looked like a team well in control. And I don't imagine many people last season would have said, oh yeah, Minnesota beat Chicago.
Yeah, I think that ball from Ethan Finley off the side was
tasty.
Beautiful.
Yeah, Ethan Finley is another rising MLS talent I'm watching more and more closely, and just a real good sense of reading the play and ability to put the pass where he wants it. That's, another one of those you go, like, how long can MLS keep Ethan Finley? Not the highest profile player, but just talent oozing out of him.
Yeah. Looking at the setup that Chicago had, I'm continuing to notice Alexandre Kitai, maybe just because of his fancy name when I see him pop around. But he did all right for Chicago, and if I recall, was a part of the goal, but I can't recall in which way. But It was Minnesota's game, and you're happy to see that because of the expansion Cousins, Atlanta has always gotten the attention. But you have always got the sense from Minnesota fans that they are waiting for a great product to watch.
And I think they've been given I really can't stress enough how much credit I give to Minnesota fans for staying by their team last season and not writing them off and celebrating the victories where they can, or where they came, rather. It's tough at times to watch your team lose so many games and give up so many goals, but I feel like the fan base never really wavered. And I think that's paid off well, that you have so many returning players. Obviously, now the fact that they're missing Kevin Molino for the whole season is going to hurt things. But it's also one of those opportunities for the team to kind of galvanize, rally behind each other, for the supporters to rally together and go, like, we've got a good team here. This is not a shitty team that needs to totally rethink the game plan. They took a season to kind of figure things out. They kept a lot of the really key pieces and a lot of the great pieces. And I think that I would not be surprised, even though it's very early days, if at the end of the season, Minnesota's sitting fourth or third and vying for a playoff spot. If they're able to keep this momentum going, they look to be a really good team and a really gritty team, a team that actually, that doesn't give up and can grind out wins.
Mm-hmm. The last game, the one that we haven't...
I think that's all the games. I think the show's over. I think we've covered all the teams, especially the Canadian ones.
You know, I tuned in late to Vancouver, Atlanta. I didn't see Kendall Watson, so I assumed he was being rested after the trip to Mexico. Wait, you're telling me that the Whitecaps... The Whitecaps didn't make any trip to Mexico? They just lost 4-1 to Atlanta? And...
Yeah.
What happened? What? I mean, like, I know a lot of it is just comes down to the elemental fact of being upset by the loss of such a key piece with a red card. But what happened?
So I'm glad you said that. And I don't want to give too much airtime to the red card decision. I think I've already lost some friends on Twitter because after the initial call, and I wasn't really paying attention to the game, to be honest. I was kind of half had it on. Because I wasn't sure how it was going to go. I went, look, there's an elbow to the face in the box. That's a red card all day long in MLS. Upon hearing some others' arguments, upon seeing other replays, and upon the fact that the Whitecaps have now actually appealed that red card decision to the league. Is it Gonzalez Perez, the defender? I mean, whoever it was, like, basically runs, like, sees the arm extended and runs into it. And falls down. And it's a beautiful bit of acting. But I can also... I see how in the run of play it would be something to be called. The fact that, though, it took 12 minutes for VAR to come to a decision, and it happened so late after the fact, and it's got to be a clear and obvious error. And I think that's the piece that Robinson and so many other people are so upset about, is that there's really not a lot in this one. And... you have, like, especially with VAR, I would get it more if right away it was called as a penalty, and that's just what the referee saw, and then they went to VAR and they overturned it. But the fact that play was fine, and then play continued, and then they went back, and then reviewed it, was kind of like, well, but if, like, clear and obvious error, to me it's just not there. My initial reaction was... Vancouver Whitecaps fans and media were just losing their minds and not able to maintain any sort of impartial opinion about what had gone on. But yeah, the more you look at it, the more you're just like, no. There's no penalty there.
Like you, I didn't get the argument either. I thought that when you were looking at it, I just, you see context, so you say, hey, that makes sense. But when you say that, I do see the argument that there was, it was, face to elbow instead of elbow to face.
Yes.
And the what's sort of pernicious about that a little bit, and this isn't to say that there is, a conspiracy or whatever else, But like, what's pernicious about it in the era of VAR is that you can't really Zapruder that. Because, you know, if you're going, his elbow goes back and to the left.
Yeah.
If you're going frame by frame, it's obvious that there's contact made there. But you kind of need to have more of the speed to get where the force is coming to. And so I guess it's kind of like a tailor-made for VAR issue. Or a tailor-made to beat VAR issue.
Yeah, and, you know, I think one of the reasons why I was initially frustrated is because Whitecaps fans, I mean, and it's fans of any team, the second a call goes against them, just loses their minds, and it's just all conspiracy theories, and every team thinks that. And that's kind of where I leapt to, but that did kind of cloud my vision a little bit for the fact that, okay, it's got to be a clear and obvious error, and the referee's right there. If he didn't see it, and he's looking at it, and he says it's no penalty, it shouldn't be VAR overturning the referee. It should be the referee using VAR to correct a decision that was wrong. Also the fact that it took so long. Also the fact that this referee has now, I believe, three times given our team red cards on kind of inconspicuous plays. Although I haven't gone look back at the other red cards. That was just a stat that from the backline released. Or AFTN rather released. I'm not interested in having the discussion about referee conspiracy theories. I don't think it leads anywhere productive. But it is a pretty shocking red card incident. However, it's easy enough to say, well, that killed the game. In the 13th minute, they went down to 10 men, and that's what lost them the game. But I actually thought the setup, their formation to begin with. I was going like, what now? Against Atlanta, yeah. You're going to pick your time to play the back three? I get Marcel de Jong was still out and not available. But it was a bit of a head-scratcher of a formation to begin with that was always going to put a ton of pressure on the back three, especially against a back three that is pretty much completely untested except for Kendall Waston.
Yeah, that was a real head scratcher for me because the 3-5-2 is something we had heard about all preseason, but when the lineups both in the preseason and in the regular season started to come out, it stopped happening. So I guess I kind of assumed that it wasn't going to come around, and I certainly didn't expect to see it on the road in front of 45,000 people.
It wasn't so much the formation. It's like you're on the road against one of the toughest at-home teams with one of the most lethal attacks in MLS, and you're going to decide to play three defenders at the back. Okay. Sure. And, I mean, I just thought from there, you know, Aja had a pretty poor game. Mond had an absolute miserable day out.
Oh, remember when I was, like, going to heap scorn on that impact defender I was thinking of, yeah. Aaron Mond, who put the ball in the goal. It's tough. It's tough. You can't, you know, own goals are scored all the time, but it's just a sign of how much was going wrong so fast.
Absolutely. And I was disappointed with that. Some of the senior midfield players for not doing more. And this is maybe a little bit of bias, but watching the way the game played out, I went, this game was screaming for Russell Tybert in the midfield, just screaming for him to run players down, to close space down, to inject some energy into the team. And it was just really disappointing to see the Whitecaps. I mean, they did fight, but they never really looked in it, except for, and this is going to be the thing I focus on,
yes.
The one bright spot is, yes. Eric Hurtado comes on, silences all the haters, does what we know Eric Hurtado can do, and at least gets us, you know, something to walk home and not say it was a complete blowout, and gets his first goal of the season. So the way I sum up this game is Eric Hurtado scored a great critical away goal against one of the toughest teams in MLS.
Yeah. And was that his first of the season? Does he? Is that him opening his account? That's great. It's great to. It's great to see. He's, you know, I feel like this year it's he's been a little bit of the forgotten man, and unlike past years, it's not like he's gotten a lot of time to prove or disprove his own case. So it's nice to see him taking those opportunities.
Absolutely, and I mean, we've seen Eric Hurtado grow and grow and grow, and he's been with the team for a long time. And I think over the last few seasons, he keeps coming back, and people are sort of like, "What? Really? That's the person we're keeping?" But I like this idea of kind of letting him and Blondell fight it out for the second striker role. And, you know, we know what Blondell is capable of, but is a very different type of striker. But, again, I just think Hurtado continues to prove his worth. And, sure, so he makes it 4-1 instead of 4-0. But we also saw the same type of work ethic and capability of scoring a goal that gave them a crucial away game victory against one of the toughest defenses last year in Kansas. So you do need players like that. And I think it's easy to forget as a fan or a commentator of the game that you do need players that can come in and, you know, maybe they play 8 or 9 games a season and they only get 3 goals. But 3 of those goals could win you games. And if even one of them gets you 3 points in a conference like the West, I think that justifies keeping them around. Eric Hurtado is not going to be the starting striker in the Whitecaps anytime soon. We know that. But he also seems to be settling into knowing that as well and really playing. If he fancies himself as a super sub, I think that could see the Whitecaps through this season very, very well.
Where I'll be critical, obviously I'm not critical of bringing him on because he scored. That was great. But the fact that in a scenario like this where you're playing down to 10, that your sub, I don't know what happened to the formation and who sort of slid back and what they chose to do at that point, that Eric Hurtado is coming in on 55 minutes. This is to your point about Tiber. You get your only central defender sent off while you're playing a 3-5-2. And your first two subs
players
on 45 and 55 are your forwards, and your second one is I guess at the 67th minute, Effie Juarez is kind of more of a DM, isn't he? Take out for Reyna, but still, wow, just nothing to stem the blow, you know.
No, and I actually thought we'd see Ethan Sampson in this game. The new right back from DC. I thought that this could have been a game that he really could have come into. I think Jake Nowinski did okay, but I sort of thought maybe having a little bit more experience on the pitch, also knowing that Sampson can play as a winger as well, has that capability, and is a versatile player. I was a bit surprised that that wasn't the choice. So, yeah, it's easy to say, well, they were down 10 men from the 13th minute. Yes, that is true. However, the subs were really head-scratchers as well, and you just sort of thought, I don't think there was a way, considering the Whitecaps lineup and the way they played and the substitutes, that they were ever going to win this game.
The one thing, of course, you got to say it. Joseph Martinez with the hat trick, again, I understand, was
Ethan
phenomenal.
Ethan Sampson hasn't played for a team forever. I'm sorry. Sean Franklin. Oh, Lord.
Sean Franklin. I was wondering. I was trying to connect the dots.
No one's ever going to listen to this podcast again.
These all four goals just knocked all the sense out of our heads. Yeah, sorry.
It was that mystery elbow to the head that did it.
I ran into
Kendall Waston's elbow, and I can't think straight anymore.
He ran into my elbow. He ran into my elbow 10 times.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
But yeah, that was... No, it was good. It was good. No, so it was... It was goals 2, 3, and 4 of the season for Joseph Martinez, and he looked great.
Yeah, and I believe he's now one hat trick away from the all-time MLS record. I don't know that that says so much about Atlanta as it does about other teams' defenses, and just giving them way too much room to maneuver. But I'm excited to see teams that shut them down. And we've seen teams shut Atlanta down. But at the end of the day, I'm going to say hats off to them. They did score the four goals. It didn't happen just by pure luck. But mm-hmm. certainly getting gifted a red card to your opposition in the 13th minute certainly can give you the upper hand. But I think this was always Atlanta's one to win, unfortunately.
Yeah. Do you know what Vancouver, you know what the Whitecaps had in common with Chicago this week? They both no longer have a chance to win the World Cup.
That's true. We did share that this week. I've been dreading this topic. How much I hate soccer politics.
I've got something fun after this. So we'll end on a high note. But let's get into it.
We must.
The deadline for submitting the bid packages for the United 2026 Canada US Mexico bid was last Friday, and the preliminary of that that bid, I guess, was cities deciding once and for all if they were in or they were out. Vancouver was the first. They were not the last. BC's provincial government dropped out of the chance to host. Basically, it was weird in the way it happened because kind of it was motivated by how one politician was talking in a press conference or a question period, and people began to leak out that basically it was likely that they were not going to get in on the deal, and then they basically announced that they had a number of concerns based on the initial documents, and they had also asked for assurances on how much they would be responsible for to pay in terms of overruns. They said they did not get that information, and without the information, they were out of the bid. This at the time, I think there was a little bit of an outcry because people want nice things, and this would have been a nice thing. And it was strange out of nowhere to think that, you know, this is the first. I honestly think other than the potential for Morocco to upset the things just because FIFA likes to have an alternative option on the table, this was, I think, the first bad thing that I had heard about the 2026 bid from anyone. So I think people were a little surprised, but once people got a look at the details, I don't know. As soon as it started to came out, I tried to keep my eyes on the prize, which is do not trust FIFA.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised and actually quite disappointed in the local Vancouver media, and I don't want to overdo it here because, you know, I like a lot of those people, and I learn about soccer through them, and I learn a lot about the Whitecaps through them, but there's an awful lot of short-sightedness and reactionary things coming from people who I sort of thought a little bit more of in terms of nuance and understanding. That just simply like,
we're World Cup, but I want to see it real bad, and this is outrageous.
And you're like, well, okay, hang on a minute. They're like, we had the Winter Olympics. You're like, right. And remember all the bullshit that the IOC pulled in Vancouver and how much money it cost the city? And, like, I'm sorry. I love soccer. I love it to death. And I really want to love the World Cup. But considering the amount of insane corruption, politics, suppression of freedom of speech, crazy advertising rules and labor rights that are ignored to put it on, I kind of go, I would rather not have that in my city than just pretend like everything's okay and sink a crap ton of money and resources into something that, like, let's face it, so you can watch Croatia play Chile in a round of 16 knockout. Like, it's just, come on. We're not hosting the World Cup final in Vancouver. And FIFA, as you said, is not trustworthy. And once you saw the conditions and the types of the lack of information, the lack of readiness, my main takeaway from this is, how does FIFA get anybody to sign on to anything, considering their total incompetence at providing any sort of details? I mean, if I was like, Andrew, I want you to host a party. The whole world is coming. I'm going to need you to redesign a bunch of stuff, but I can't tell you exactly what. But if anything happens bad and you need to call in, like, say, the National Guard, you're going to have to pay for that. But I really want you to host this party.
What's hard for me at this point, when I look at it, is how early things had to be sort of agreed to and sort of signed off on. Because this sort of information, like you say, is not available at this time. You know what I mean? And I, like you, I don't want to pick any fights with anybody. I understand that the tough part is... that I think no matter what side you're on, it seems short-sighted.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Like, it's tough because when you feel like something is the obvious, like somebody is overlooking an obvious point that's going to have real consequences, it can feel so frustrating. Because if your thought is, this is such a... The Olympics were so important... The Women's World Cup was so important. This is going to be so important and so notable. I can't believe that we wouldn't just buck up and do it. I can understand that a little bit, and I can understand why that would be frustrating. But when you look at it, I'm looking at the Bob Mackin's website, thebreaker.news, and some of the things include... that they would like a tax exemption for a decade.
So you and me both. Most Vancouverites would. Some Vancouverites already have that, but I'd like that.
Yeah, they would like the unrestricted import and export of all foreign currencies.
So, in other words, ability to have unabetted, untracked gambling. And laundering.
There is a line. This will by no means limit or restrict the applicability of laws and regulations around
not at
money
all.
Laundering.
But if a few billion dollars gets lost in a real estate deal, whatever.
FIFA not only wanted the rights to install a grass pitch in BC Place, which has been a sticking point for
Pavco. Would be nice.
They wanted BC to pay for a second grass pitch just in case. It would be in storage. Like, it would be
That makes more sense. I was like, are you just going to, like, roll it out in Kitsilano or something and on the streets down 4th Avenue and then...
If for some reason all the grass dies or, like, somebody... Like, you know, if the screen drops and it cuts a big divot out of the grass.
Do they know how much it rains in
BC? another big sticking point was that BC would have been on hook for the security costs. They also wanted labor law exemptions.
Yeah, which, by the way, just to clarify, everything else aside, by the way, just that one point, that's fucking illegal in any country. Just for the record, you cannot just decide. Mm-hmm. A corporation cannot just say labor laws are illegal. And also, that's why so many people have died in Qatar. So many people have died in numerous countries that have hosted World Cups. Just saying, it's fucking illegal.
We are still 4 years away from our ethical reckoning of the fact that the World Cup... is built on what is effectively slave labor, and we haven't done it yet. But if you are aware of the fact that it's happening, you should look at that. Not that I'm suggesting they're going to extend that system to Canada by any means, but if I was the provincial government, a party that controlled that government was perhaps labor focused.
Well,
That would be a red flag for me.
The other thing that I noticed, too, is the political bent of it. And I know for most of our listeners, I don't want to get too involved in it. But provincial politics in Canada is messed up. In BC, it's even more messed up. And suffice to say, the commentary around this really took aim at the fact that it was the provincial NDP, these lefties who don't want any good times at all and just want to put money towards silly, frivolous things like education and childcare, but don't want to just have a big party, that was really the tone that affected a lot of it, which was that it was sort of this like, well, Christy Clark and the Liberals would have approved this. It's like, well, yeah, sure, corrupt politicians to corrupt politicians would have okayed anything. Is that success? Anyway, I've revealed my political biases, but it was sort of that lens of like the real focus got turned on the political party that turned it down, which is like, well, regardless of the party, a government has a responsibility to its people and to its taxpayers to not screw them over for a generation. And I, quite frankly, whichever party turned this down, I appreciated that they looked at things like, labor law exemptions? You know what? I think not today.
I think before we get out of the topic of the politics, I think that the decision whether or not to approve the Vancouver Olympics was viewed skeptically by a certain segment of the population in British Columbia, and those people supported the NDP. Not that should mean, and not that the decision should be made with the public interest in mind specifically, but the point is the government changed and the political calculus became different. But the broader point than politics that I think is sort of the issue with this is, I'm really critical of the Amazon HQ2. You bid to host our business approach. And I guess, you know, the World Cup is, you're always going to have the country is going to have to do a bid. But I don't understand why cities are bidding to join the bid, right? Like, the bid wants to be, and maybe this is, they're not thinking this way because they're thinking that they are the monolith or the obvious right choice. But I think that you have this deadline and this refusal to provide answers to some reasonable questions. I think, and I said this on Twitter at the time, I think it's the bid's loss.
Hey folks, it's Nick here. Unfortunately, we had more of the episode and my file got corrupted. So that's where we're going to leave it. But that means we've got lots of stuff for you next week. So I'll do the little outro here. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. That would be helpful if you want to catch every single episode. And you can find me online tweeting, making lots of friends at That's So MLS. And, of course, you can find Andrew Bates at Team Bates. Wait, do I have this right? No, oh, I need Andrew here. Well, you can find his work at whatahowler.com. And also, of course, you can find this podcast at thatsomls.com. And send us your questions if you have them. If there's stuff you want us to talk about, like the fact that Ibrahimovic is actually coming to MLS, hit us up and we'll talk about it. Okay, that's it. That's the show. Bye.